Call to order the 68th meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Jack Schreier, I'm a Morris County Freeholder representing the public of Morris County.
Scott Whitenack, public member from Morristown.
Tracy Coraluccio, excuse me, Hunterdon County public representative.
Jazz Kovach, town of Clinton, Hunterdon County.
Bill Cogger, mayor of Chester Township.
Amy Les, Persephone in Morris County.
Tim Gillingham, public member.
Glenn Petrano, Sussex County Freeholder.
Do we have any members on the phone? We do have a quorum present. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we have in our packets the minutes from our last meeting on May 1st.
Move those minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Any corrections or comments on that? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Okay. Welcome Kurt Olstead with a haircut. Immediately after, or within a few minutes after this morning's council meeting, we'll have a meeting of the Transfer Development Rights Committee in this room, I assume. The only other item I want to mention is that the Senator Smith has brought up a water fee bill for consideration of legislature. There was one hearing that I think Swan will talk about. There was another hearing that had been scheduled for this coming Monday, which I gather has been postponed, but we have on our agenda an added item to talk about whether we want to take a more explicit position or even more explicit position than we've taken in the past in support of that. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. Are there other items other council members would like to bring up? It's fine. Okay, then we'll turn to the executive director's report. Eileen Swan.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is fun. I'm just trying to get myself out of here. Since we last saw you, we had our usual meeting with the county planners. We had some municipal and county outreach on April 29th in Warren County. There was a program called Leadership Warren. It was sponsored by the Warren County Chamber of Commerce. And Mary Jude Haddock-Weiler attended that and actually sort of gave a class and spoke to the chamber, to the leadership group that were there about opportunities under the Highlands Act with things like ecotourism and redevelopment opportunities. We had a presentation at the New Jersey Water Environment Association on wastewater management planning, April 30th. Dan Van Abs did a presentation there on behalf of the council. I had a meeting with the District 24 legislators at their request to bring them up to date on the plan, where we are, and the scheduled date for consideration of adoption. Mary Jude Haddock-Weiler also attended the a workshop on the crossroads of the American Revolution. It was a collaborative workshop. And then the other issue that the chair mentioned was testimony at the Senate Environment Committee on amending the Constitution to dedicate water consumption and diversion user fee revenue for open space and farmland preservation. Myself and Tom went down to that, and Council Member Gillingham was there as well with his two hats on, American Littoral Society as well as the Highlands Council. We gave testimony there in support of the amendment to the Constitution to allow for this. This is something that we've spoken about in the past. In your packet, you do have a written copy of the summary of the testimony that I gave. In particular, what we focused on was the fact that the Highlands Act has a specific mandate, and the words are, a strong and significant commitment by the state to fund the acquisition of exceptional natural resource value lands. And this council has constantly promoted the water user fee, and the fact that the connection is very clear to make if 18% of the land base of the state of New Jersey, that is the Highlands, provides the water for over half the population of the state, those that benefit from the protection of the resources should share the burden of the protection of the Highlands. It would help us both in conserving the lands, and also help the TDR program. So working with the chair over the past week, what we did is we put together a packet so that we could send a letter to all mayors in the 88 municipalities of the Highlands, letting them know that the Senate Environment Committee is considering this resolution and asking for their support. We send the chair will be sending a letter, and with that will be a fact sheet, some of the facts and numbers and details, and also a map which shows the Highlands area and the areas outside of the region that get the water from the Highlands. We've also prepared a letter to each of the senators, and what we've done in that, as well as the fact sheet and the map, we're also providing to each senator a listing of the municipalities in their districts that get a percentage of their water from the Highlands. And this is to try to garner some support for the initiative. There is at this stage, they're only looking at the resolution for the amendment to the Constitution. There is a companion bill, but further work may be necessary on the companion bill. So that's all that I have on that particular issue. Now we have the May 16th is the next County Planners meeting, and we have an informational meeting in Franklin Borough, Sussex County. That's one of those evening meetings where we go and talk at the request of the municipality. We talk to them about the plan and its implications for them. Other than that, we have the resolutions before you today and the regional master plan discussion items.
Questions further? I don't think we have any committee reports, so let's discuss the resolution.
The first resolution is the one that I've been speaking about. It is the support for constitutional amendment to dedicate the revenue for open space and farmland preservation. We did provide the public with copies of the concurrent resolution and the testimony provided on your behalf at the Senate Environment Committee hearing.
Chairman, I only find the draft of one resolution in my packet. Am I missing it?
It's two sides of this one's two sides of the page.
I saw that. This concurrent resolution number 88 is the one to which the resolution refers.
The two bills in our packet. Yes,
that's the same one I have.
What is it you're missing?
We're talking about two resolutions, are we not?
No, we're talking about one resolution.
Oh, okay.
It's one resolution.
One resolution.
Okay. It's to support the Senate concurrent resolution number 88. Okay. Yes.
Shall I move it?
Sure.
Okay. I'll move it so that we can comment.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Any discussion, questions?
I would like to speak about this. We have been advocating as a council that there be some sort of a user fee for Highlands Water to be dedicated to land acquisition and landowner equity in the Highlands. Since our meeting of Parsippany, that's in March of 2005.
Yes.
I met in a municipality when we were mayor there. And we had a consensus at that time. I think there was a general motion made. And what we're talking about here will be an amendment to the Constitution that hopefully, and I say that with not much optimism, will result in legislation that will address the issue of landowner equity in the Highlands region. And I'm not sure that that's what we're going to get, because there was a bill proposed earlier that apparently is no longer viable. that seemed to go much farther than that and was not narrowly focused on the Highlands region. So I have no problem with sending this notion of a constitutional amendment to the voters. I have great faith in the voters' judgment. But this is not now specific to any piece of legislation. I just wanted to make that point.
Other comments?
And this is, I mean, it's certainly, it's far from a certainty that this is going to get through the legislature, much less on the ballot.
Sure.
But
there
no other comments? All those in favor?
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry, public comments. Okay. Yes, sir.
My name is David Shope, and actually there is a water user fee already assessed by the New Jersey Water Supply Authority. Ed Gein, Frank Ricker, and I began a letter writing campaign some time ago, and the Water Supply Authority has adopted initially a $5 per million gallon fee for preservation of lands that they consider valuable to the watershed. That's now at $8. It's not much, but it's a beginning, and perhaps this is an avenue that you would wish to explore. There's an equivalent to the New Jersey Water Supply Authority up north. I forget the name of it, North Jersey, whatever.
North Jersey Water Supply.
Right. So between the two, they would cover the bulk of the watershed area in the Highlands area. These two water supply authorities both are functions of the state government. And also, if you quantify it a bit and reduce it to numbers which are turn out to be rather insignificant, you may have a better shot at getting this sort of thing through. And the number I'm using is one that was done by Warren County in their lawsuit against you and the state, where they indicated they hired a guy who does this for a living and came up with the figure of $15 billion and lost landowner equity. That sounds like a big number until you start to divide it into the huge number of gallons that are provided by the lands in which precipitation falls. I did an analysis, and I said I'd furnish it to you. And unfortunately, I missed the date for the last Water Supply Authority rate increase, so I put that on the back burner. But I can furnish it to you. It works out to be a rather modest amount, like $35 per million gallons on top of what the Water Supply Authority charges. Incidentally, they sell water to various water supply authority or water purveyors, including for-profit ones, at cost, and cost is cost. It's all the cost of operation, the money required to pay the bond, principal and interest, stuff like that. It works out to basically what Senator Smith is proposing in his bill, or has said publicly, about a dollar per person per year would do it. So perhaps if you quantify this and put reduce the huge number into a rather small number per capita per year, you may get somewhere with it. And also, perhaps the best avenue would be to contact the water supply authorities directly and see if they can't build it into their one of the costs of delivering water to the purveyors, as the water supply authority has done. Thank you.
In the draft letter we have to the mayors in our packet, we estimate it would estimate $32 per household on average would be the cost of the current proposal.
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. Just two requests. In your whereas, 1, 2, 3, fourth whereas, you say that the Garden State Preservation Trust Fund funds the Green Acres Program and the Farmland Preservation Program. It also funds the New Jersey Historic Trust. The New Jersey funding for historic preservation has been left out of this the proposed bill and SCR 88. And we would ask, since it is an important part of your mandate, we would ask that you request that that be added back in. I know that the committee is considering that at this time. The other thing is, in your resolution, you do not mention anywhere in here a number, but you do just simply say that you are supporting SCR 88. The bill that has been proposed recommends a number that would raise approximately $150 million a year. And we would ask that you ask for them to support at least $150 million per year. This is a 10-year sunsetting bill that has been proposed for acquisition and for stewardship, since stewardship is also an important part of what you have been talking about and should not be left out of what you're supporting. Thank you.
Yeah, on this resolution.
Oh, okay. I have one additional comment, Mr. Chairman. I'll reiterate and reemphasize that this resolution is not attached to any specific piece of legislation. There are no figures in here. There are no numbers in here for that specific reason. All this resolution will be is to support the idea of sending to the voters for their consideration an amendment to the Constitution that is not attached to any specific amount of money or any specific bill. And if we went into the other direction, as has been described, I would be very uncomfortable with supporting it without an analysis and study of the legislation that has been proposed.
Other comments?
Would you agree to add the historic trust?
No, I think we've already done that in that particular whereas it says and other programs. So I think we have covered not only historic trust but any others that might have been inadvertently omitted from specific business.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yeah.
That's when this thing starts to get diluted and watered down and never see the light of day. If we're that serious about the equity issue, let's leave it in equity and put the other stuff aside.
Well, I'm not hearing anyone who wants to make an amendment to this resolution, so we're ready to vote on it as is. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Has someone joined us on the phone?
John, it's Debbie.
Okay. So you were a yes vote on that?
Yes.
Okay. I see another member approaching.
Okay.
In the distance.
Okay. So it passes unanimously. And do we have planning assistance grants to discuss?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Okay.
Really bad accident, 517.
Yeah, we're not involved.
No. But somebody in a Jeep, I hope is okay. His Jeep was destroyed.
Debbie is on the phone. No? Okay. Okay.
There are two resolutions before us today for approval of planning assistance grants. The first that I'd like to deal with is the resolution for the Township of Clinton for a COA grant. And so if you pull out the two and look at the now, therefore, be it resolved last law, you'll see COA, because they're not numbered, in fact, to assist you in focusing on that particular grant application. It is for the Township of Clinton for the Fair Share Planning COA third round grant in an amount not to exceed $7,500. These are the grants you've done before, and Clinton is now requesting that we consider that grant for them.
Is there someone who moves it? Anyone second? Second.
I'll second it.
Discussion? Comments? Public comments?
David Shope, I'm just curious. Seems like you're giving the Township of Clinton a lot of money. Has anyone tallied up what the various grants have been to Clinton? I know you gave them $30,000 to look into their water deficit. And
that's the town of Clinton.
The town. What is this then?
Township.
Township. Okay. Well, let me ask the same question. Has anyone tallied up the grants to the Township of Clinton?
This is the only grant.
This is the only one.
Township of Clinton.
Okay,
today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Other comments from council members? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Okay. So that was it. Okay. So we now move into the...
No, there's another resolution.
Oh, there's another resolution. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Another resolution for planning assistance grants. And this is the first of the initial assessment grants, and it is for the Township of Chester.
And I'd like to recuse myself and move away.
Okay. Are you moving away?
We've had considerable interest in these grants because they have to be accompanied by a resolution from the municipal governing body. Many of the towns have indicated to us that they obviously have to wait until they have a duly advertised meeting so that they can do the resolution. So the first town that has fully done the application with the accompanying resolution is the Township of Chester. So it's for initial assessment grant to look at plan conformance in an amount not to exceed $15,000.
Okay. Someone like to move it?
Move.
Okay. Second?
Second.
Okay. Comments?
I want to ask a question. The $15,000, I contend that some of the work that will have to be done to get in to qualify for plan conformance is going to be considerable. This $15,000, can somebody come back and ask for some more if that doesn't cover their costs?
And this is not for them to do plan conformance, because you're quite correct that it would be considerably more than this. This is really the first look-see by the towns to consider the implications for their particular town in consideration of plan conformance.
They can come back then
and yes, they can.
More once they've done the initial assessment. We're not going to have a problem.
They can do it under this, and then when they go through conformance, there'll be a separate set of available funds for each of the plan conformance elements.
For each of them?
Yes.
Questions? Other questions or comments? Any public comments on this resolution? You ready to vote? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Bill abstained, I guess, by definition. Okay. You can tell Bill all is forgiven. He can come back. And we now move to the regional master plan discussion.
Okay. As has come to be practice here, we have a PowerPoint to guide the discussion for today. The first issue that we will discuss in terms of changes made to the regional master plan in terms of comments received is for the carbon at rock goals, policies, and objectives. Text has been added to clarify that karst is not strictly a surface condition. And we've expanded the text regarding functional values that carbonate rock provides. So much more added information here. Language added regarding the importance of prolific carbonate rock aquifers in the region. We have two new objectives regarding instances when specific karst features are identified. And the first is to prohibit new land uses and any facilities that would constitute unacceptable risks in areas with karst features. And this is because of the nature of these features for sinkholes and issues of that kind. And the second new objective is to prioritise upgrades or remedial actions for existing high-risk land uses and facilities in areas with these karst features. So that's pretty much all that's in carbonate rock. Everything else really is clarification and consistency of language.
Comments or questions?
I have a comment. Yeah. I think this is good. You're pushing this out more, and the objective 1K4, E, and F, that those are good additions. I have a question and a suggestion. On objective 1K4E, underground storage tanks, solid waste landfills, and then the hazardous waste facilities and handling areas that you're talking about. Superfund sites are one sort of obvious issue under the next 1K4F that I would suggest we add, and also taking from 1K4E the solid waste landfills that exist and the existing hazardous waste storage and disposal facilities and hazardous material storage and handling existing areas and adding them under F as well seems to make sense in terms of remedial action. So I would suggest that.
Okay, we can add that to 1K4F.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Other comments? Okay. Yep.
Okay. The second issue for us today is prime groundwater recharge. In the 2006 draft of the regional master plan, 125% mitigation was required for development of prime groundwater recharge areas, but there was no distinction made between the land use capability map zones. Also, in the 2007 final draft regional master plan, we continued that 125% mitigation requirement and included complete prohibition on development of prime groundwater recharge areas in the protection zone. But we didn't have other restrictions, and neither did we have prohibition on development in the other two zones, the conservation zone and the existing community zone. And these drafts did not specify water quality considerations in prime groundwater recharge areas. So we wanted to address this final iteration of the plan for your consideration of adoption to change the approaches here. So we wanted to continue the 125% mitigation requirement, but clarify that it applies to the portion of prime groundwater recharge area that is developed. It's not for the entire site, it was never intended to be, so this is a clarification. Include a clear policy for avoiding prime groundwater recharge areas using low impact development. Create a scale of permittable disturbance that is most stringent in the protection zone and addresses the conservation and existing community zones. So this gets back to the issue that we had that complete prohibition in the protection zone, but we didn't have prohibitions in those other two zones. To ensure that potential contaminant sources are prohibited in the same manner as we do in the wellhead protection area tier 2. So this is to be consistent with those policies to make sure that we're looking after water quality issues in groundwater recharge areas. Limit wastewater utility expansion or creation in these prime groundwater recharge areas in the protection and conservation zones. So what we've done is this gives you a sort of an overview of the approach. In areas of prime groundwater recharge areas, when we're looking at the protection zone, the disturbance, you use low impact development to minimize any disturbance. We established a 15% maximum disturbance limit if no cluster or waiver is used. No upper disturbance limit for clusters and waivers as long as the low impact development is used to minimize. Of course, all other resource protections have to be utilized there as well. So you have to consider all this. This is just one of the many issues we look at when we're looking at any kind of development. In the conservation zone, again, using low impact development to minimize. In this case, it would be 30% maximum disturbance if there's no cluster or waiver, and again, the same language for clusters and waivers. And finally, in the existing community, again, the low impact development, and then 45% maximum disturbance limit. In all of these areas, 125% of pre-construction recharge from the disturbed portion of the prime groundwater recharge area. And that's mandated. And then for water quality constraints, this is added, it was missing from the 2007 final draft, new development controls equivalent to the Tier 2 wellhead protection area. And so this is to protect against discharges to these sensitive areas. And existing development management equivalent to Tier 3 wellhead protection areas.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have a couple questions to make sure I understand this, and then I have comments if I do understand it. Objective 2D4A. Am I understanding then that what we're saying is that clusters can encroach on prime groundwater recharge areas with no restrictions?
Don, can I ask you to?
The whole issue of clusters is a combination of policies. And so basically the way it works is that when you're going to have a cluster, you would have to look at all of the lands that are involved in that cluster, and then you would look to see where can you put the cluster. So with regard to some policies, we have an absolute restriction. Critical habitat, for instance, stream buffers. In other cases, such as prime groundwater recharge area, the idea is to use low-impact development and the site design to minimize the extent to which you approach in that, but to not put an absolute cap on it. And the reason for that is that it's much easier to mitigate recharge than it is to mitigate habitat damage.
Okay,
so
well,
that's the balancing test. Yes.
Thank you. I thought that's what it meant, and I would like to object very strongly to this. I think we're making a huge mistake to allow clusters to encroach on prime groundwater recharge areas. The way the draft is written, it prohibits disturbance of groundwater recharge areas, and now we're allowing clusters to go into those areas and encroach on them. If we start infringing on our groundwater recharge areas, we are directly impacting the water resources of the highlands because those are the areas that feed the base flow of the streams. So I don't see how we can justify in any way encroaching on the prime groundwater recharge areas. And I disagree. I disagree that with two things. One, with the approach that, oh, because we've weakened some other areas, we should weaken this area. Second approach I don't agree with is that I don't think it's necessarily true that it's more difficult to renovate a forest area than it is to clean up polluted groundwater. And I know that you mentioned quantity, but I think we also have to look at the quality impacts of the clusters. We are allowing greater nitrate concentrations in clustered areas. And then we also have the nitrate contributions from the agricultural areas that are attached to those cluster areas. So what we're doing is we're concentrating nitrates in prime groundwater recharge areas. If we do not prohibit the intrusion of cluster development activities in our prime groundwater recharge areas. In terms of groundwater pollution and the cleanup of groundwater pollution, nitrates, as we know, are very difficult to get out of the aquifer. They're soluble. They very slowly renovate. They take years, millennia perhaps, to renovate. And they also do not attach well to sediment. And these are known scientific facts, you know, based on EPA, USGA studies, you know, basic texts, that we know that nitrates are a problem. They're very difficult to remove from groundwater. So I think that we should not accept the change in this objective and policy, and we should keep in place a prohibition of any development activity on our prime groundwater recharge area. Also, would just like to say that these percentages, they're so high. If the maximum disturbance limit as it's characterized there is actually a limit on impervious cover when you look at the objectives. So to allow that much impervious cover on prime groundwater recharge areas where there aren't clusters is also, I find, extremely objectionable and really working against ourselves and protecting our water resources. So I strenuously object to this change. And I don't think it's in keeping with public comments or with the direction that the draft is already going. I think it's a major policy change.
Just wanted to clarify one point, that the council would be approving cluster ordinances in municipalities, and I think that what we had tried to do was sort of take them out of this realm and view them on the merits of each cluster. And so it wasn't that you would sort of have a free-for-all on the prime groundwater recharge areas.
you would be considering the cluster separately in those cluster ordinances, which would give the council an opportunity at that point to decide if those cluster provisions were protective enough of the resources, and all other resource protections would be applied as well.
This would set a ground rule for our review of the cluster ordinances, though.
Well, in this case, the clusters are dealt with separate from this. So this doesn't give a limit for the disturbance in prime groundwater recharge areas for clusters. And I would also tell you that you didn't have, or we didn't have in our 2007 plan, any disturbance limit in the conservation and existing community zone areas for prime groundwater recharge. So we've added those in this case, so it's more protective. And allowed to that 15% in the protection zone.
I have a question.
Just a minute, Debbie. Bill?
If we don't approve this, does that prevent someone coming in from asking for a waiver for these regulations if they had a development that was encroaching upon a prime water recharge area? In other words, if we leave it as it is today in the protection area, as a complete prohibition, does that prevent anybody from coming and appealing to the council?
I guess anybody can appeal at any time, but what it would mean is if you had, I'll just give an example, a water quality management plan amendment in the protection zone, and the area was prime groundwater recharge area, then the council would say that that amendment was inconsistent with the regional master plan. Okay. If we didn't have this language there.
And then they could apply for a waiver, and they would go before them?
Yes, I mean, the concept of the waiver policies is to allow for, right now they're primarily used for DEP rules, but the waivers built into the Act will allow relief from the policies of DEP rules, and we're building in similar policies for the plan.
But the waivers are limited for their, they can be applied for,
on a case by case basis,
for many takings and...
Yes, there's three major waivers, public health and safety, redevelopment, and to avoid a takings.
Debbie?
Yeah, I have a question to follow up on Tracy's comments. This, I'm looking at the overview of approach table and the 15% and the 30%. It's stated here as maximum disturbance limit. Is that what it is, or is it impervious coverage?
Maximum disturbance limit, Dan?
The policy is written as impervious surface.
Well, that would seem that this table is misleading. This should be saying impervious coverage.
Right.
Isn't that what it really is, which is very, very different from disturbance? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Dan seems to be nodding. I don't know if you can see that on
the phone. No, I can't hear that. I mean, this is very troubling. There is a big difference between disturbance and impervious coverage, and I want to add very troubling, because this is yet another indicator of the problems in this process. But to Tracy's point, she is right on. This is a major policy shift. This isn't a tweaking of some words and policies and objectives. It's a major policy shift, and it has not been directed by the council. So where is it coming from?
It's coming from the staff, and the council is discussing it today. So that's.
I would also tell you that it was part of the discussion when we did the Canfield project review. And it was at that point when we went through that review and the applicant worked with us to meet, and I have slides, Mr. Chair, if you want to look at them, but when the applicant met with the staff to stay out of the different areas, such as critical habitat and the buffer areas, and the final sort of hurdle was the prime groundwater recharge area, and it was at that point that we realized that there was no approach that they could really have any development on that site because we had a complete prohibition. So it was out of those discussions that the staff then looked at it and then also compared to the conservation and existing community zones where we didn't have any prohibition. So this had to be addressed because we were not consistent in our approaches having any protection in two zones and then a complete prohibition in the other zone.
And where does the 15 and 30% come from?
I'll let Dan talk about the analysis he did to get to that.
Yeah. Basically, these are policy numbers. The top limit, the 45%, is based on the sort of zoning that we have in the Highlands in the existing community zone for maximum impervious cover. The conservation and protection zones are stepped down from that to become consistently more stringent. They are absolutely policy numbers, and so that's open for certainly for discussion. The other thing that I would mention, and I've got to emphasize what Eileen has said, the conservation and existing community zones under the current policies of the final draft plan have no limit on the disturbance of prime groundwater recharge areas. And so this is a significant strengthening from that perspective. Whether it is strong enough for various council members is a different issue, but it is a strengthening. The only reduction in strength is in the protection zone, and that's from wind disturbance, which in some cases is going to drive people to...
Dan, could you repeat that? I'm sorry, somebody was coughing. I couldn't hear you.
That's
just the very last part.
In the protection zone, that's where we step back from 0% to 15%. And the issue there is if you allow nothing, then you're going to have everything involving the protection zone coming through the waiver process. And so that's complicated. The 15% was felt to be a sort of a minimal amount. Again, I do take the point with regard to the difference between disturbance limit and impervious surface. And that's certainly something I think we should go back and take a look at, because you could easily write this policy in a different way so that it's a certain percent maximum amount of the area that does not engage in natural recharge. So basically, if it's disturbed, if the stormwater is rerouted, then that would be part of that percentage. So there are different ways of going at this question.
And there's a real general rule of thumb that a 10% impervious coverage is sort of a threshold. Above that, you start getting deterioration. And so very specifically, too, why on earth would we go 15%? Why would we go 15% in the protection zone? That seems too lax and inconsistent with the act.
The 10%, as you say, is not only general, but it is not site-specific. It's watershed-based, and it has always been watershed-based. The application of that to site-by-site isn't actually where you want to go, and this is 15% of just the prime groundwater recharge area within a site, not 15% of the total site. The total site will be restricted by septic system density requirements and a whole slew of other resource protection issues. So that's where you get into the distinction between the infringement on the primary groundwater recharge area and the infringement on the total site. They're not the same. They're absolutely not the same. And a watershed-based impervious surface rule of thumb is not equivalent to a site-specific. They really have to be kept separate.
And what would this translate? You think this 15%, what would it translate into in a watershed? And I know there's no way you can calculate that, but I'm trying to get at where this specific number, where it came from. Is there some standards it's based on? Is it just judgment?
It is a step down from the existing community zone level. And so it's a management call. It's a policy call.
Okay, thank you.
If you figure that in a watershed, about 30% or so of the watershed will be prime groundwater recharge area, and then you would be talking about a maximum of 15% of that. So 15% of 30%. So that's about 6% or less.
What I would also remind the council is that on each of the applications that would come before you, when you're looking at the prime groundwater recharge area, no matter how, if you have a large area of the site, which is prime groundwater recharge area, you also have to take into consideration all the other resource protections before you get to the portion of the prime groundwater recharge area that you're allowed to disturb, because other disturbances may be prohibited through other resource protections, as would be the case when we looked at that Canfield site.
Does that mean we're going to look at every application?
Debbie, excuse me. Tim?
I'm sorry.
I thought you were finished, weren't you? Go ahead. And we'll come back to that.
Okay. I think in terms of the changes that are being proposed for the protection area, that's absolutely the wrong direction to go in. The groundwater recharge areas are sort of the critical pieces of the green infrastructure in this region. And I think Dan just made the distinction that in most cases, we will not be talking about an entire site. So part of the concern with both the complexity of evaluating variances or concerns about not allowing any development on a property, that's probably a fairly small portion of it. But even with those considerations, I don't think should trump the fundamental idea that in the protection areas in particular, these are places that ought to be off limits of development. They're just irreplaceable. I don't have a lot of faith in, and I think, again, we've had this conversation about the water supply issues, that low impact development, while I think it's a place we ought to be going for, it's a very, very new science. And I don't think the track record about whether or not it would create a comparable offset to not building on those portions of the site that function as recharge areas is proven at all. So I think it's a bad policy decision to go in that direction. And then in terms of the thresholds, I will just note that in the coastal areas, there are impervious cover limits on major developments there. In the most environmentally sensitive areas, the limit is 3%. And that results in suburban scale development. That's 6 to 7 acres per unit of housing. Just to give you a sense of how that would play out in the landscape. So 15% and 25% and 30% are very, very intensive coverages, and I think totally inappropriate. And then lastly, I would agree with Eileen's observation that we ought to put explicit standards in place in the zones other than the protection zone to clarify what those limits on development ought to be in the groundwater recharge areas.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Would like to suggest that for the protection zone that we leave it at 0% and let the waiver process play out. That's why we have a waiver process. If somebody wants to go through the process to try to achieve a waiver, they have a right to do that, and the process allows for it. But I think that we need to have standards, strict standards in place, and we don't need to open that door just to make it less cumbersome administratively, which is sort of what I heard. So I strongly think that we should go back to the 0% of the protection zone. I agree that we should have some standards in the conservation and existing community zone, and would also like to point out the environmentally constrained zones perhaps should be tweaked to also have different percentages, but I think these percentages are way too high. I hear what you're saying, Dan, that the 10% is not based on scientific analysis of individual sites. However, there is a lot of scientific study about the impact of impervious surfaces on aquifers. And I think if we look at that and take a scientific approach as opposed to a policy or administrative approach, we'll see how really outsized those numbers are. And I think that we should reconsider. We should have a white paper that informs our decision about the percent that we're going to allow in the conservation and existing community zone and the environmentally constrained zones, and should be based on science in terms of how the aquifer responds to impervious cover. But also just like to say, pollution prevention is so much cheaper and is so much more effective than allowing pollution to happen and then trying to fix it. So I feel very strongly that we have tried throughout this process to prevent degradation, to prevent pollution through the RNP. And we need to stick to that in this instance. Why on earth would we allow disturbance and pollution, impervious cover and pollution of the prime groundwater recharge areas in the protection zone? That is the most important, environmentally sensitive, valuable area in the highlands. It just doesn't make sense. And then in terms of the conservation of the existing community zone, we need to set standards. I agree with that. I think that those are way too large. We need to have a scientific approach to it, like we try to take to all of our other decisions that we make here.
Would we consider some kind of a language that allows, in a situation where you have a de minimis amount of the prime recharge area being touched by a possible development, that would be allow, or at least considerable or allowable, so that we don't really burden our waiver process.
It gets to a question of what de minimis is, I assume, but that, I mean, we're poised to say something.
Would that be too cumbersome?
Well, I think this is what we were trying to do here, is because we looked at the application that we had, and then we're trying to see how it would be best deal with projects such as that, that would, in terms of what would be minimal practical use of the site. And in our, when we, back in March, when we were looking at the issues that we were going to bring before you, that was what brought this one before you, because when we looked at the different resources we were looking to protect, we saw an opportunity to mitigate here, whereas with other resources we didn't. So a site becomes limited by very many resources, and when you get down to this, then it's not, you can't go back out into those areas. So it was 15%.
I mean, so you could say, I mean, you're,
I understand
you could say de minimis up to no greater than 15% or some other.
It's the same argument that we have, you know, when we're looking at all the environmental constraints, and I think it's an argument that a lot of the council members have brought forward, that seems like one little small amount of an item is going to exist everywhere, and we're going to continually be having heated discussions. It would be nice to somehow have some kind of relief.
Mr. Chairman, you all may be shocked. I agree with Tracy on this issue. I think that we need a white paper to inform us. I think that we have not got sufficient information as a council. Some members seem to be more knowledgeable about this aspect than others, and I think that information would only be valuable for the council if we're going to make a new policy decision on this stuff. So I'm very much in favor of learning more about this, and I would think that the rest of the council would not object to that as well. But in the case of the application that you referred to by name, that application is not relevant anymore. This policy would not apply if, in fact, it were adopted just as it has been proposed today. So that's a non-issue now. You're looking to the future and other projects. And I don't disagree that we need to ease the administrative burden if possible, but I also agree that we need to continue the protections to the greatest extent possible. So I'd like to learn more about this personally. That's just my own opinion.
Yep. I agree with Tracy and Jack. I think that's really the case where we need to head.
Debbie, is your comment still pertinent?
I've forgotten it, so thank you. Thank you. It must not have been important.
Okay. Well, if there's no objection to that, could we do that? And I think what would be helpful, too, with whatever else is in a white paper is some drawings that would show the effect on it.
Yeah, we'll look at a case.
If I just add one sort of guiding philosophical thought, which is that I think we ought to structure these policies in a way that, again, changes the status quo and how development happens, right? One of the big problems with the stormwater regulations that are out there, they have this same aspiration that they would change the way that development was arranged on the landscape, and they have not done that. There's a lot of criticism about how effective they've been in doing that. We ought to make sure that our policies are clear enough that it has that driver effect to have development or town ordinances or whatever the issue is at hand be looked at through a lens that minimizes the pollution, that avoids it, that avoids these protected areas. Because to go to Scott's point a little bit, I think when we look at the region, we ought to be very concerned about death by 1,000 cuts. Cumulative impact of development across this, 100,000 acres of land that's going to be open to development is very much at risk, I think, when we start to let small pieces be infringed upon across the land. So as you do your evaluation, I'd ask that you look at that. You look at that idea. How do we structure the policies clearly so that they lead to this site design work that results in pollution prevention, and that you look at what the cumulative impacts of whatever your recommendation is.
I think one thing that may help us with this is when we show you the tool we spoke about some time ago, which is sort of the next phase of the property search tool, where you'll be able to put in block and lot information throughout the whole region. and be able to have all the layers available so that you can look at a site and see what are the constraints on each site, which basically does then guide where development may occur, and sharing that information out front so that people can see it before they consider what they'd like to do with the land. I think that, that we had said to you that we would have that, our goal was to have that before adoption of the plan, that tool available for the full public as well. I think that will certainly help Tim in showing how development will be guided to the appropriate place, if there is an appropriate place on the site.
Right, as long as that information, to go to John's point, that information is backed up by clear policies that say, when you see a groundwater recharge area mapped, you know that the RMP is not going to allow you to develop in that area. So find another portion of that site to site the buildings and the roads and everything else.
Yes,
that's
our goal. Okay. All
right, let's go on.
The next are transportation goals, policy, objective changes. Here, again, in response to comments received, some clarifications. The need to evaluate transportation projects that may result in unintended growth or growth-inducing effects due to increased motorized vehicle roadways. And I remind you that we do a project we're working with the Voorhees Transportation Center. Requirement of the Act that the Regional Master Plan recognize projects that promote a sound and balanced transportation system consistent with smart growth principles. We committed to doing an analysis of this, again working with Voorhees Transportation, and these are the goals, policies, and objectives. We're calling it out in the introduction here. We're also going to have more on that in the program when we bring that to you. Recognizing the role and agency coordination with the 13-county Metropolitan Planning Transportation Region that the Highlands region resides within. We had already in our 2007 draft spoken to coordination with NJTPA and Transit, but you know, being a regional planning agency, it's important to know our place within the 13-county Metropolitan Planning Region as well, so we included that. Those are all the clarifications. A policy was added regarding the role of regional airport facilities within the Highlands region. Text was added recognizing the shuttle as a form of local transit. We took out names of any particular types in dealing with DOT. They suggested that we just refer to it as the shuttle. A policy was added regarding scenic byways and corridors in the Highlands region. So mainly just some clarifications, but a couple of additions in response to comments received.
I mean, where is the airport policy? Identify what is the title of it?
5A2C.
5A2C.
2C.
Okay, thank you.
Kurt?
I know you're working with Voorhees, but it does say shall include projects, not recognize projects. And I think that that's a critical part of what we need to do with this final master plan, is include projects, not just recognize them. I think we're driven to make recommendations.
Right, and what we're doing, you know that we talked about this, Kurt, that we're working with the Transportation Center, and also understanding that the studies that are going on some of these transportation projects will not be complete by the time the regional master plan, but what we want to do is focus on those that we think are A, the most appropriate, and the most right. And so we will have some proposals for you when we bring the program to you.
Prior
to the July 17th, yes.
No comments on transportation?
Well, it's on your obligation for July 17th.
Okay.
Redevelopment, the program and policy, goals, policy, and objective revisions. A more detailed description in this now of appropriate redevelopment activities for each of the land use capability map zones in the planning area. These activities may be approved through plan conformance or the Highlands redevelopment site approval process consistent with resource protection policies. Municipal conformance requirements were updated to include the identification of development, redevelopment, and brownfield opportunities in the local land use element of the master plan, and development regulations and zoning amendments to enable project implementation of identified redevelopment initiatives. So this was just an update to make sure that this was covered during the municipal conformance process.
I had a question on this.
Policy 6L1, which says to require the conforming municipalities identify development and development brownfield opportunities in their master plans. And then a little later, I don't know where, but somewhere we say, you know, if they have the infrastructure. But I think we should just say where appropriate, because there, it's possible that a municipality does not have any of those, and it's making it sound like we're requiring them to come up with them. So this is where appropriate, and there's some good language a little later on that says where appropriate or where infrastructure exists, or, and I think we should modify it.
So that's good. We'll add the clarifying language there, and you're right.
Thank you. Thank you.
We had a discussion about this.
We did, yes. It comes up actually later in this PowerPoint as well, where we talk about a plan conformance element to recognize these redevelopment opportunities. So we did discuss this in one of the briefing calls yesterday.
Great. I had one other question on the last objective, 6M1D. Is there a mechanism at DEP for this now, these enhanced remediation standards? Is this something already in place, or are we going to have sort of a Highlands version of that, or how do you see this actually working?
The Act gives us the ability to recommend to DEP modifications to its technical standards that they would incorporate into an existing body of regulations. This is something that's going to take some time because obviously we have a few other things we're going to have to get through, like conformance. But it is in the Act. It is a specific provision of the Act, and we felt that it was appropriate to have an objective in here that keeps our mind on this over time. So we do have the ability, and they do have existing regulations. We would be asking them to modify those.
I think that's an excellent addition. And it carries out what we're required then to do in the Act.
Other comments?
Can we go?
Yeah.
Thanks. Goals, policies, and objectives for smart growth and low-impact development. We modified the narrative in this section to better describe low-impact development as an element of smart growth that allows the natural features of the land to guide the site design, stormwater management, and resource protection. We elaborated on low-impact development strategies to be utilized in design and development, stormwater management, and resource management, and gave some examples as following on the slide. General strategies such as water conservation requirements, site design and development, such as limiting the building envelope and using energy efficient features. Stormwater management that mimics the natural hydrology of the site and uses grass channels, bioswales, water gardens. All of these are low impact development strategies. And resource management, avoiding resource or minimizing negative impacts to resources.
How do we implement that?
Through plan conformance, we'll work on with municipalities. Sometimes it may be, in where appropriate, incorporated into their ordinances that they would look to make sure that these are done, certainly when it comes to stormwater management and issues like that.
I would just encourage, and this is sort of a parking lot issue, but as I said, there's been some criticism about the point system that DEP utilizes as a way of implementing these LID approaches. And so I hope that as we go forward, we're cognizant of those problems and we don't just simply repeat the same mistakes. And I don't know how it's done necessarily, but I know that there's been some technical evaluation done by some of the conservation organizations. I know Tracy knows a huge amount about stormwater, the program there. But I just make sure we go beyond having the right words and the right goals in the plan to something a program is actually going to work.
Okay.
Tim, excuse me, were you referring to the formula that creates a specific number of parking places?
I'm not very familiar with this at all, but my understanding is that when you comply with the stormwater rules now, you go through a point system that evaluates a variety of best management practices, and you're supposed to total some number. And that's taken as validation that you've met these goals of low impact development and recharging. And apparently, the point system doesn't work.
Right.
Totally agree with that. And I think DEP is aware of this criticism. And definitely, we should do better.
We shouldn't use the point system. We won't use the point system.
Other comments?
You use letter grades, right?
Thanks, Tim.
Head right there.
The next issue we discuss here is landowner equity. Due to many of the comments received, we changed the title to equity as opposed to fairness. It was more consistent with language used in other documents. And
what's the difference in meaning?
I would ask you, Councilmember Shire, if you'd like
to. I looked
to.
It up.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Equity means fairness.
It seemed to resonate better with those that were responding sure. to the document. We revised language in two of the policies to reflect that the TDR program is not limited to use in the preservation area. This was really a clarification that sending zones may also be identified in the planning area upon plan conformance. And for example, when you saw the grant from the town of Clinton, they're considering plan conformance and doing that TDR feasibility study where they would be looking to the council to consider, if they prove to be feasible, a sending area and a receiving area within the town of Clinton. So we wanted to make sure that that was clear in the document, that they could have, sending zones could be identified in the planning area upon plan performance. They would obviously be the appropriate areas that meet our standards.
The way I read this, I had a concern that it shifted sort of the priority of our attention away from the preservation area. You set me straight, that's misreading it, but and again, I think if in the conversation we had a year ago about the TDR program, if there is a TDR is going to be a valuable but fairly limited resource to carry out the goals of either offsetting the exemptions or, you know, meeting the compensation issues where the land's completely constrained, or advancing the conservation goals of the land protection goal. So do these policy changes spread it out, and are we now going to be allocating, make sure that Scott does as well, but we're going to be allocating TDR credits across the region as opposed to prioritizing and focusing them in assembling, you know, undisturbed areas within the preservation area?
We focus on the preservation in our studies, and we've done it in our conservation priority lists. We've done that kind of a focus. We've also done it in our the confidential list that we've done, that the focus primarily is on the, we do it across the region, but primarily the focus has always been on the preservation area. So too has the first phase of the TDR program. At the same time, we wanted to allow that the council has always recognized that there are critical areas for protection within the planning area. And this was to allow for, during the conformance process, if there are appropriate areas in the planning area that could be considered during plan conformance. Again, it comes back to the council to make the decision. But our focus has always been primarily on the pressure-driven nature of landowner equity in the preservation area. A bit of both.
I'm not sure that answered your question.
Well, I'm not sure where it'll be said, but I think there'll be a number of places where we're going to need to say, in land acquisition, for example, that there are a lot of areas that they're this highest priority from the perspective of the Highlands Plan, and that will be true here too.
Yes.
Right, but so very specifically, if you look at 7B9, in terms of the allocation of Highlands development credits, individual sending zone parcels, the criteria of the regional resource value of the parcel has been removed. So doesn't that undermine the idea that there's a prioritization that's either linked to our open space plan or to our resource characterization?
Yeah, that's actually wasn't the intent. I think it's going to be on the TDR committee's agenda this afternoon. But so clearly the bonus density concept is tied to ecological value. So we may need
to... Well, this isn't talking about bonus density. This talks about...
Well, it's in terms of exercising or not exercising an exemption. So I think we do need to clarify that policy. But that is what was intended, is to make sure that not exercising an exemption is tied to the higher value lands.
Right. Well, I think this language particularly needs to be
reformed. Yep, I agree.
Yeah, and
what you said earlier was true, Tim, as well, is that we've put a great focus on contiguous lands within the preservation area that are very environmentally sensitive to be the top priority. But then it's always dependent on the willing landowner as well to get involved in the program.
Well, yeah, absolutely. This is clearly a willing owner program, but it can be structured in such a way that certain willing owners are more prioritized than others.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the debate about whether or not the program is intended to help effectuate a land pattern or to compensate people for some diminution in development potential, mm-hmm. where there's a priority there.
I'm sure we'll have a discussion this afternoon.
Being a rather close reader, I have one small nit to pick, I'm sorry. The fifth paragraph on the first page under part 7, right on the right way. Second line. What does it mean?
Just the tens of thousands of acres paragraph?
Yes.
Okay.
Based upon an analysis conducted by the, I'm sorry, it's just a typo.
Thank you.
I think we need a white paper on that change.
We had discussed including a statement on equity in our draft plan. We had floated some language around the last time. We concluded that we needed a little bit more time to consider language before we adopted our next draft. Have we had any movement on that, or do we need to set something in motion for that to happen? Just a general equity statement from the council to include in this part of the act.
You want us to draft a sort of an equity statement?
I had suggested language when we adopted the last draft, and the conclusion was that there was a lot of support for an equity statement, but we wanted to have language in advance that we could consider prior to the next draft. In this case, the final plan being approved.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think this does that, right?
No, I think clearly not. Really, this is a TDR. This is more about TDR than anything else. It doesn't speak to our commitment or recognition that the landowner equity is a priority for the council. I think it's almost a little bit of a philosophical statement.
Do you want to forward your suggested language, and I can work with the council, and we could, if the council agreed upon something being put in at the beginning of this under landowner equity?
Right. So you're suggesting it be more like, more of the document, I think, right?
Well, I think it needs to be someplace. We can put it up in the wherefores and whereas.
This is just one tool because you're the problem.
Right, I think the TDR is a tool, but I think that we had discussed a statement that we are committed to compensating people for the loss of equity due to the implementation of the Highlands Act.
Right. Well, why don't you do what I mean suggest, because maybe it could go right here, because I think this isn't just about TDR, but it does read that way.
I
mean, it does read that way.
I think that we want to broaden it, not just from the TDR, but to other acquisition.
Right.
Well, and as the chair says, this introduction does deal with acquisition. It also deals with the exemptions in order to get to the equity issues and the provisions that are set forth. But
it could, for example, talk about the kind of positions we took this morning in terms of the council's advocacy for.
Right, and they do come up under goals, policies, and objectives. But if you wanted that somehow succinctly put into the introduction to this, we can work on that opening statement.
Thank you. And just to be clear, prior to plan adoption on the 17th, we will have the method of allocation of credits finalized. I know we've talked about it, I just want to be clear.
Oh, I think I will bow to the chair of the TDR committee, but that's what they will be working on this afternoon. And the answer is absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, just on the equity statement, just might just ask that when the staff, are you going to paragraph that, or is the staff going to draft that?
Well, Kurt said he
has to. My point is, just reflect what the statute has already decided about how equity is addressed. Right. Because we should not go beyond that, is my point. And, you know, just by way of example, I don't know how many years the State Planning Commission spent debating their equity issue, their equity statement.
Yeah, we could look at that language too. They have in the State Development and Redevelopment Plan, there is an equity statement which did take a long time and a lot of agreement. Working between the different advocacy groups as well on that language, so we can look at that language as well.
Well, unless the invitation isn't limited to Kurt, we know any of the rest of us who have suggested language can
sent to me. Thank you.
Other comments? Okay.
Okay. We added language, give me the slide, I say this is into, but we added language to clarify that establishment of receiving zones must be consistent with the regional master plan. And this was just to be clear because of comments received that there were concern, you know, receiving zones must be consistent with the regional master plan, resource protection, with capacity issues, with all of those issues. So they will all be taken into consideration if there's a petition from a municipality to consider an area as a receiving zone.
What does that mean for receiving zones outside the Highlands?
Right.
The receiving zones outside the Highlands are required under the TDR Act to go through the plan endorsement process with the State Planning Commission.
For the ones within the Highlands counties but outside the Highlands.
They must go through the State Development and Redevelopment Plan endorsement process and seek endorsement from the State Planning Commission, and that's by law. So, and they have to go through a capacity assessment and a resource analysis under that process.
But they wouldn't have to conform to all the constraints that we have in them.
They are not subject to plan conformance. And we do actually have goals, policies, and objectives that get to that. Also, for communities within the Highlands planning area that do not choose to conform, they too could become a receiving area if they go through, again, the statute, the TDR statute, which says that they have to go through the plan enforcement process. Clarified language that municipalities outside of the Highlands region, but within the seven counties, that choose to establish receiving zones must seek plan endorsement from the State Planning Commission. And planning area municipalities that do not conform to the regional master plan, again, they have to go through that process.
We'll make a flow chart.
Are you in the county?
Yes.
Do you want the money?
Some new goals, policies, and objectives. And this, I think, gets to some of what you're saying, Kurt, but I recognize you wanted an opening statement. But new landowner equity policies addressing the need for legislation. So this is the legislation that this council has been promoting. One is to permit municipalities outside of the seven Highlands counties to designate receiving zones that could accept Highlands development credits. If you recall, there was a bill promoted by or proposed by Assemblywoman Linda Greenstein, which would allow for anywhere within the state of New Jersey to establish receiving zones taking from the Pinelands and the Highlands areas. And this council was supporting that initiative in order to broaden our ability to have receiving zones throughout the state. And the second legislation that would be promoting, this is what's suggested here, requiring the payment of a fee into the Highlands Development Credit Bank for any increases in density or intensity of development beyond what was allowable as of the effective date of the Act, where that development relies on its water resources from the Highlands region. And that development is situated in any municipality other than a conforming municipality. So just to explain that, for an area outside of the Highlands region that gets its water from the Highlands, if they increase the density of their development beyond what was allowed at the date of the Act, they should then be required to pay into the Highlands Development Credit Bank. It would be a way to get us some extra money, but if they're increasing their development intensity and relying on this region for their water, they should be required to put some money in to assist landowner equity provisions in this region for the benefit they are getting from the region and from those protections.
But it wouldn't replace the water,
would it? No, sir, it would not replace the water.
How would we ever enforce something like that? I mean, how would we know, you know, when the Act was approved in 2004, right? How would we know that they didn't change the density in 2005?
We can check their zoning. I mean, you can check the zoning and you can track where municipalities change zoning. This is a suggestion for legislation, Mimi, but it's because if you're in an area that's getting your water from here and you can just increase your density and there's no
nexus connect, there's no connection with the area from which you're getting your resources, then the people up here are carrying the burden, and still these other areas are being allowed to increase development.
There's no point in doing something if it can't really realistically be enforced, and I think this would be very difficult to know if a municipality changed its density in a particular zone.
Well, this was a suggestion that we, I mean, we made as of the effective date of the Act, because it seemed to make sense, because at that point in time, I mean, when this if this legislation were to move, the legislators might change that. They might say effective as of this date. But, you know, in other words, the date of the legislation, if there's any zoning changes.
And that's potentially retroactive? In other words, there'll be a, if this is passed, there'll be a tax bill that'll meet, there'll be a bill that would be immediately presented to any community in northern New Jersey that did a zoning up?
That is what's suggested here. But again, if you wish to change that as of the effective date of the Act, you could change it as of the effective date of that bill. But really what you're trying to do here is get the rest of the state to understand that half the population of the state is currently using this area as a resource, 18% of the land base. If they wish to increase their density, they should be supporting.
I understand looking forward, I'm just wondering if you mean retroactive.
Well,
and if a town didn't know that, and you wanted them to speak a bill that they...
So if you wanted to say, if you wanted to change this right now, as of the effective date of that bill, or of that legislative action, your call, we could change that. Beyond the allowable development yield as of the date of the legislation.
Just take out as of the effective date and leave it silent on this, that subject.
We could do that very easily.
I think that's an interesting idea, and particularly the part about capturing the increases in density and making the linkages. But the money, so this is basically cash payments that will go into the bank. There ought to be some statement that the money would then be used to advance the TDR program. Because
it's going into the TDR banks, though.
Into the bank, right. But you didn't, I guess my point is to specify how it might be utilized. And I don't know. What I'm trying to get at is, in conversation I've had with people around the state, that the receiving areas don't necessarily see just additional numbers of houses or residential units as always see them as a benefit. Okay, and there's a presumption that's indeed how the urban areas in particular that we have goals to relocate some of this development into will see that. So if there's cash available, things like, you know, police protection, improving infrastructure to support the development, there needs to be some fungibility to the development potential that you're capturing. So you're creating a cash payment here as opposed to just a transfer of units. It doesn't all need to go, should not all go back simply into the landowners inside the region, but it also ought to be used, or be available to be used, to facilitate the receiving areas functioning as well.
Would you not want this to go, for example, just to specify then that money would be used to purchase rights in sending areas so that there'd be a direct connection?
I think at this point in the game, since this is an idea for legislation, you can simply say, and that funding should be used to advance the success of the TDR program.
Perfect.
Okay. But I was just putting on the table to think about the idea that simply the exchange of residential units is not necessarily the currency that everybody wants in the game. So.
Okay. So we could add that language, Councilor Sodrick.
Okay.
That
sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Great. Sustainable economic development, and this gets to an issue that you brought up earlier, Tracy. We clarified the municipal conformance requirement to develop an economic plan element. Now, in the materials we sent out to you, it basically talks about requiring that element. We put in, after the conference calls, briefing calls yesterday, where appropriate, because there may be some towns that don't have redevelopment areas or brownfield sites. So we're not forcing everybody to, as Tracy put it, go out and find them. If they, you know, there are towns that have these plans, and the opportunity, and if they have brownfield sites, they absolutely should have a plan as to how they would deal with these potential opportunities for redevelopment. So we've clarified that now to say where appropriate. We updated language in several policies to more broadly refer to the development and enhancement of the region's tourism infrastructure. Again, that was in response to comments received. And we revised policies and objectives to address public-private partnerships to support economic development initiatives. Again, from the comments that we received.
Just ask a question. Policy 8A1, where it says to maintain and expand the existing job and economic base, do we have barometers out there right now for existing jobs at the time the Act was enacted in the Highlands region? And are we tracking them? And do we have proposals to mitigate job loss because of the impact of the Highlands Act?
In
you know, for instance, perhaps we're going to find that there's 300 jobs lost in excavating because there's no more or minimal amount of new construction. Perhaps there's 200 carpenters and 100 plumbers and electricians that are all displaced out of work. What are we going to do?
When we do the build-out analysis, the region-wide build-out analysis with you, we do look at the jobs-to-housing balance, so we are able to capture, you know, within a certain framework, the numbers there. And so into the future, we do plan to do tracking as well to make sure. And then as we get to conformance with the local municipalities and get to local build-out, we look at it at a local level. So we will be able to see the implications of the plan for jobs to housing. And certainly in our redevelopment opportunities and our smart growth policies and looking at the opportunities to for redevelopment, we'll be able to capture a lot of this. But to the specifics of how many jobs in one area, such as the excavating, we don't get down to that level.
What about existing industry and manufacturing? I didn't see anything really specific to that. Is it a goal of ours to maintain the industry and manufacturing base that exists in the Highlands region right now? And if we have an existing manufacturing facility that employs, say, a couple hundred people, and to be viable, they need to expand by 50,000 square feet, but they happen to be in the protection zone, how are we prepared to deal with that? Is the maintenance... Or, you know, is the maintenance, and that expansion will add another 50 jobs, perhaps. Are we prepared to say, okay, let's look at everything, and there's mitigating factors, and everything works together? Where does the maintenance of those jobs and the expansion of those jobs intersect with all the other stuff? Because I think we really need to address that, because I think jobs are being shipped out, and we've got issues up in the trade zone, and
what we've done in looking at this to date is we see the opportunities, and there's the one exemption which allows for a 125% increase, but there's all, more importantly, we think for retention of business, of existing businesses within the area, is the opportunity to do the 70% impervious cover, which would allow you for increased impervious surface. That's where we see, in working with the couple of projects, the pilot projects we have in-house, that's the opportunity to retain business. We've also, as you know, been looking at opportunities for the area and what we should be focusing on and helping municipalities look to agritourism, ecotourism, all the other initiatives where you may see a shift from one type of business to another type that will help the area. But in terms of business retention, what we've looked at is that redevelopment opportunity. We also have, you know, you've seen some of the tool we created to look at where there are opportunities for refill and redevelopment, looking at underutilized lands. And our build-out will track, and working with municipalities, track the jobs to housing balance so that we get an idea of the implication of the plan over time as it relates to these.
But if I'm the owner of that small manufacturing plant, I look at the plan and see how I fit future of the Highlands. I don't see anything specifically that addresses me right now. I see that we want to expand home offices, but it doesn't say how I'm going to be treated, whether I'm even wanted, or maybe I become an unwanted child and I'm going to get zoned out of existence, and that's going to force me to look at other places to relocate my business. But on the other hand, if it is a priority for us to maintain these manufacturing facilities, and perhaps ones that are located alongside the various short line freight rail systems we have in place throughout the region, it may be appropriate for growth to occur there. So I wonder if we need a section that addresses that.
We could cross-reference to redevelopment in this area where we do have the goals, policies, and objectives that would relate to the redevelopment opportunities to retain business, such as that 70% impervious surface and the opportunity to get those waivers. And once you've got the redevelopment site designation, making sure that all other resource protections are in place, but for that additional growth. So what we could do is cross-reference that here somewhere, Kurt.
I think that we should be able, that's a big part of the economic base, and I think there should be something in this plan that addresses at least some general policies regarding it.
Okay.
And how it fits in.
I'd like to say that I think that Kurt's absolutely right, and I think that if we don't have some type of ability to deal with exceptions in the planning area, I think we're going to have a difficult time getting towns to, you know, want to conform to the plan if they're concerned that if, you know, one of their businesses or their office sites want to expand a little bit, but they're going to come into, you know, one of our buffer areas or whatever, and we won't allow it. That, I think that's going to be a real hindrance.
But there is a policy statement there. The presumption that economic growth has to be dependent upon developing undeveloped lands or environmentally sensitive lands, I think, is not one this council should endorse. And you get into a lot of, when you start talking about whether or not we're going to manage the economic, mega economic trends, whether it's the decline of manufacturing or industry in the state, it's influenced by a lot of things other than this Highlands Council. And, you know, who knows, maybe Microsoft will decide that Morris County, Western Morris County, is nicer than Seattle. They'll come in and they'll create jobs. Now, those are where the trends are going. I think it's very difficult for us to kind of figure out where that is. We do talk about making redevelopment opportunities available, utilizing the base. There are infrastructure policies here. I think it's just dangerous to start going into, let's start waiving the standards in order to have that happen without a better foundation of what might come out of it.
Chairman, I have fundamental disagreement with Mr. Dillingham's last statement. I think that we have an obligation to support, this is what Kurt's talking about, businesses that are already here, that want to stay here, and that want to add jobs here. And in order to do that, they need to expand the facility. And they need to do it on land that is essentially undeveloped, but it's in a zone that is primed for redevelopment. I think that to the extent that we are able to do that, we would be doing not only ourselves a favor, not only the Highlands region a favor, but the state of New Jersey a great favor as well.
But where's the policy that prevents that from happening, Jack? Though, if they're existing development, they're existing businesses, they're in the existing community zones, or they're in the identified centers, they're not in the environmentally sensitive areas. So this is the argument of we need to build right up to the streams in order to keep the economy going. I just think it's unfounded to say that it's actually a problem.
I think, well, that's where I was going, because I think part of it is a package or a when we adopt a plan, we need to have, whether it's on the website or brochures or something, that says, what's this mean if I'm a homeowner in the Highlands today? What's it mean if I have a business in the Highlands today? And I remember from one of the recent public hearings when there was a farmer who thought the Highlands plan meant he had to stop farming. I mean, there's a lot of information. So when you put all that together, I guess the question is whether what that adds up to is enough. But if you say, if we say, okay, if you operate a business today in the Highlands plan doesn't cause you to change that in any way. If you need to expand that, here's what the Highlands plan says you can do. And there are constraints, but there are also possibilities up to a point. And make that clear to people. I think that's a big piece of what you're saying. And then if the council members think that doesn't go far enough, we can talk about that. But my sense of where we are so far is it does. I mean, it allows for someone who has an existing business who needs to expand it has more opportunity to do that than someone developing starting fresh with an open piece of land because of the exemptions both built into the Act and the policies built into the plan. But
what are those policies that you're referring to?
Well, I think you referred to them a minute ago.
Let's say you have an existing building. Let's say you want to add 1,000 square feet to it, but somehow you're going to come up against one of our regulations.
That means it'll be more than 125% of the enlargement of the footprint, you're saying.
Well, you can, I mean, that's the first thing. You're exempt under the Act if you want to enlarge it by
125%. And then we have our redevelopment process, which allows for the council to designate a redevelopment site, 70% of which must be already existing impervious surface. So, and in working with, and a good example was that the Borealis property in Mansfield Township in Warren County, where they, in order to retain that business in the Highlands, they need an opportunity to do an expansion. So we've been working with them and with DEP, because the first step would be you to designate the redevelopment site, and the second step would be for DEP to grant the minimum waivers necessary to allow that to occur. So it's a two-step process, but we have done a lot of work.
So if somebody wanted to expand their business and that expansion somehow got into the 1,000-foot preservation area around a vernal pool.
But if it was within 125% of the size of the footprint, they wouldn't need it. They could do that under the law.
Only it makes a little house for the salamander.
I'm just talking about even in planning areas of a town.
We do an analysis to look at the resource as well to see where that development should occur, because on a site, if there are resources, because remember, it is you that get to designate the site. So the first thing we do is we look at the environmental resources there and seek to protect those and see where the development could occur without negative impact. If there is some negative impact, then it requires the waiver from DEP. I'm talking about preservation area at this point. And so you designate the site, and then they get to do the waivers.
Other comments?
I had a different comment. Just a question, really. On the new policy 8E2, where it says to develop a fiscal impact analysis, is that something that we would do, and when would we do that? And
in your most recent document, we've actually removed that as of this morning, because it is something that we wish to do, but it's one of our long-term goals. So we were shifting into program, because we do not have the capacity to do that as of the day after you adopt adopt a plan. So we put it into our long-term goals, so it has been removed from in the most recent document.
I think that's the right decision. In light of that, policy 8A6, where we're requiring conforming municipalities to develop an economic plan element. I know we already had that in there, and is that changed too?
We're adding where appropriate to that.
I realize that, and that's good. But I'm suggesting, and I know we said require in the draft, but thinking about what a huge deal it is to do these economic analyses, just like us to think about changing require to encourage, because it's very expensive, and that the where appropriate would apply to the development, redevelopment, and brownfields opportunities, but there also seems to be another element here that they would be required to develop an economic plan element to address, and that would be achieving sustainable and appropriate economic development. You see, there's other language in there beyond the brownfields and the redevelopment.
Well, given that, and this gets back to your other issue in terms of balance here, we are requiring all the different plan elements that seek to do the protection. Part of our mandate from the Act was this sustainable and appropriate economic. And in terms of most towns, if they have whatever they have, whether it's a general store or some, that there should be, we believe there should be some sort of planning for the future of those businesses that is in the town. And the use of the word sustainable gets to the fact, I mean, sustainable in terms of protections as well as in terms of the business. So staff really believes that in order to achieve our mission, that the comprehensive planning would require a town to look at its resource protections, but also at opportunities for development, redevelopment. And we did add the word where appropriate, so that if they do have those businesses, if they do have redevelopment or infill development opportunities, that they should do the appropriate planning for those.
Well, the economic plan element, then, I would suggest I don't know what this would look like how big a deal it is, and I would suggest, like all the other things that we're requiring, that there be a model, and that's very clear what that means, and so it isn't you know, so burdensome.
If you're going to designate an area for redevelopment, you're going to have an economic plan. Mm-hmm. There's no way around that. So it exists just by virtue of the fact that you declared that a redevelopment area. So, and there are a lot of resources available for towns that want to go through that process that are not cost prohibitive. The overall economic plan maybe is more of an issue in terms of, but it depends on whether it's an opinion of a planner or whether it's a detailed analysis.
I just think we should define it and make it clear what it is we're requiring if we're not going to change the word require.
Well, it's an interesting point, though, because since we've been clear that we are not, that a town can conform with the Highlands plan, we're not forcing any development on that.
Correct.
A town could choose to conform and say they want no new development and they're indifferent to the continuation of their existing commercial development or whatever. And they, a town could conform without doing an economic analysis, is what I'm trying to say, seems to me.
Right.
I mean, there might be very few that would be in that category, but they could.
Well, you know, we added the words where appropriate. I'm just concerned here that if you have areas, gray fields, if you have underutilized sites, if you've got infill redevelopment, if you don't plan for them, they happen absent planning. If you work with the municipalities through comprehensive planning, you can look at these areas, and if the town decides that it is not going to allow growth, that would be part of the plan. But they surely should have some idea of what the future is.
But this is economic. We're talking about economic planning here. I mean, we're not saying throw planning away. Mm-hmm. It's just another economic plan requirement that I'm really on questioning.
One question. If a town, let's say a town says, we're fine. The question is, how do you know you're going to stay fine? That doesn't require an economic analysis, an economic, you know, econometric analysis. It doesn't require all of these very, very highly detailed. It requires attention. It requires a look to the future. And so the idea is to have these plans basically be scalable, so that someone who has very little need and very little potential for growth is looking at how do they maintain their base, and someone who has a great deal of need and a great deal of potential for growth would be going through a significantly higher level of analysis. So when you say there needs to be a template, a model, an approach, absolutely, because in some places the response to one of the items in an economic plan analysis would be not applicable. And that's all the analysis that's necessary for that section, and that should be acceptable to us. So I would absolutely agree that there needs to be basically plan performance standards that tell people exactly how to do this and exactly what you don't have to do if you don't need it. So that it's very small for people who have very small issues, and it's larger for those who have larger issues.
It gets back to the issue that if you don't do something, it happens.
The towns for COA are dealing with job criteria in terms of where, if you're going to designate an area for redevelopment, it's a process. It's not just something on a chart. I mean, the reality is you're going to do most of that stuff if you have it, so if it exists. And your master plan is going to have an economic component to it. So that may be sufficient to answer the questions. I don't know that we need more than that. And every town's got a master plan, and every town that is run has an updated master plan within 5 years. So, I mean, I think that may already exist within the communities. The notion that somehow a town isn't going to plan for a brownfield site or doesn't have any attention is just silly, because they're going to come say, I'm going to fix this dioxin, 2 acres that's contaminated with dioxin, and we're going to put this clean nuclear power station there that will benefit everybody. No town's going to do that. They already have plans about it. I hope.
What about if we change wording to something like, to say, to require that conforming municipalities develop an economic plan element that provides strategies for achieving any sustainable and appropriate economic development and identifies development and redevelopment opportunities that is consistent with the regional management plan and desired by the municipality?
Okay, consistent with the regional master plan
and desired
by the community.
Yeah, municipality.
Well,
Let me just say, though, a municipality, I mean, you can create zones. You can create retail zones, you know, and you can create office park zones and things like that. And you can do that all from the standpoint of planning. That doesn't mean that they're going to come just because you create zones. You know, the free market is out there, and businesses are going to be where they find the greatest advantage, and it may not be in a town that wants them and zones for them and plans for them, but they may not come. I mean, look at Morris County in the trade zone in Mount Olive. It's struggling, you know, because they did all the right things. They planned, they zoned and all. But for some reason or other, the market doesn't necessarily want to be there enough to fill up all their plans.
I think maybe you'll find there's a lot of that will come out in the regional build-out analysis study as well, because just because you have an industrial zone or a commercial zone, neither does that mean that it was actually appropriate, because if the infrastructure doesn't exist to support that kind of zoning, often what you find, and I can think of, if you go through Long Valley, you find that some of the greater farming communities are in the industrial zone. So,
but it doesn't all have to do with infrastructure. I mean, it has to do with just location, for whatever reason, company wants to be one place rather than another.
I think is economic plan element a term of art in MOUL or something? I think that may be what's, because I think what it seems to mean here is a plan for any development and redevelopment the town wants. And we're, I think what Tracy started originally is sort of interpreting it as a heavy-duty economic analysis of the feasibility of development or economic or redevelopment.
It's to plan for what they want for their economic development and to identify within those communities that have development, redevelopment, brownfield opportunities to plan for them.
So it's basically a development and redevelopment element, not a...
I agree. I think it's so broad. It makes it sound like you have to do it's kind of heavy-handed. I think John's suggestive language does lighten it up. It makes it clear that it's what's desired by the municipality and is consistent with the master plan, and we're not putting this heavy burden that they have to develop this economic plan for developing their town, which is the way it reads now, I think.
Okay. So we can change it then in that way.
But Mr. Chairman, you raised the idea that we had made a policy decision early on that conformist would not force growth.
Right.
So as a requirement, doesn't that lead them down that path? Well,
that's what I was adding to read.
Is this an encouragement policy?
It's if a town wants to grow, it needs to plan for that growth. So if we can rephrase that, we're not trying to force the town to grow. What we're saying, though, is if they have these opportunities that they identify, development, redevelopment, brownfield opportunities, they need to plan for them. So if we can switch this around, if you're finding, if it reads to you as if we're saying, we're going to make you grow and we're going to tell you how to do it, that was not the intention. It is, we have, Washington Borough, for example, wants to work with us. They've got a lot of redevelopment initiatives that they're engaged in right now. And so obviously working with a town like that, we need to see the plan, and not just for that Main Street area, but for the whole town. So because it gets to all the capacity issues. So maybe we need to rephrase this in such a way that it's based on their desire that we may, that if they wish to grow, they have to plan for how they grow.
I think John's language is appropriate. I would simply reverse where desired by the municipality and consistent with the plan. So I would move the where desired prior to the consistency requirement.
Okay. And we would also just consider when you're reworking this, changing the word required to encourage.
I was going to say the same thing.
I think that we should do one or the other. I mean, I think what I was suggesting saying was, if a town wants economic development, they have to basically show that it's consistent with the regional management. Well, they have to show, they have an element of their plan that shows what they want and how it's consistent with the plan. And that would be required, that they show that.
Right.
If they have no economic development that they want, then they
don't have to show it.
Right. Well, why don't you work with the wording and
yes,
we can all, I think we're close to saying the same thing. And
I think we are too. But again, that's obviously okay. Our lack of clarity there.
Good. Quick question. Is this the only place that the cash flow timetable is being included in the plan under policy AP1? Or is this, or does goal AP just reference the cash flow timetable and there's another whole section of the plan that deals with the cash flow
timetable? There is a section and it shows the cash flow timetable that's in the program, I believe.
You know, all the GPOs are followed by a more detailed program.
So this just references it someplace else?
Yes, you'll see the chart and you'll see the time now.
Which we haven't reviewed yet in anticipation of the 17th, is that correct?
It was part of the not 2007 draft release and it will be updated.
Right, we haven't reviewed
it. No, you haven't seen it more recently.
Is this a typo that says all revenues and costs associated with the Highlands Protection Fund with the exception of Highlands property tax stabilization increase?
No, it's not. It's part of the...
We're not going to be tracking the Pinelands dollars.
But we do receive the monies from which is extracted a portion for them, so we acknowledge it. We updated language in several of the policies just to more broadly refer to the development and enhancement of the region's tourism infrastructure. Again, in response to comments, and revised policies and objectives to... public-private partnerships. You heard it twice, Tim, so it was fast.
I'm starting to believe.
Air quality is the final goals, policies, and objectives. Receive comments on air quality GPOs. Wanted to clarify that the monitoring and assessment of air quality for the Highlands region is consistent and recognizes power plants, landfills, and incinerators as sources which are included in the state and federal monitoring programs. So we just changed our language there to be consistent with those programs and recognize that. Recognition of additional key air toxic compounds were added to our including but not limited to language. So regarding air toxics, in order again to be consistent with the state and federal programs. And text was also added to clarify that the regional master plan, energy efficient and green building policies would support both the New Jersey Global Warming Response Act and the state energy master plan. So just wanted to stay abreast of what's going on in the state, make sure that we have our language that makes us consistent with them.
Thank you. We are picking up this discussion a week from today at 4 o'clock. Next Thursday at 4 o'clock is our next council meeting. Is there any other comments from council members at this point? Are there any public comments?
Hi, Helen Heinrich. I'm trying to go first this time instead of last. The economic development plan element is something that is suggested by the MLUL in order to make the master plan comprehensive. And I must say that most towns don't do this because they look at economic development like Mr. Cogger sees it, the informal economic development plan. Economic development should be looking at the ag businesses. It should be looking at the existing small businesses, and towns don't do that. And there is no support for what these businesses need. Now, in your policy, later on, you say identification of specific economic development initiatives which would encourage and promote eco, agri, and heritage tourism. Don't you need a plan for that? It seems like this was a huge step in the right direction, finally, in the state of New Jersey to get back to comprehensive planning. And it's an opportunity for a town to look holistically at what they're doing instead of just at their natural resources, their school children aspects. So I guess I disagree with all the weakening language, and I sure hope you go back and at least make sure that your other suggestions about economic development get some kind of planning in your language. in the landowner equity section, I think the money for increasing the density sounds like a very good idea, but there's no coordination between all these other programs, and before you can just add another cost to a receiving area, you probably ought to be considering this, the development community and what they're already facing with impact fees, affordable housing payments or providing, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very, you know, it sounds like a good idea. I'd certainly like to see more money in the bank for acquisition purposes mainly. But, you know, I fear that there's everybody is adding costs to the development so that the receiving areas will be even harder to do than ever. And the last thing is, I wonder how many of you have actually been able to take a site or a county or a town and have the staff apply all the map layers to it. When we do that, we get a black map. And so it's very frustrating to hear people continually ratcheting up the standards for one particular natural resource area when we all know there's 12 other ones that are going to affect it. So I hope you'll do that with care, and I support the keeping some flexibility in the recharge areas. You haven't got it anywhere else, and this gives you a little bit of opportunity to do something on a site-specific basis.
Thank you.
Deborah Post, I own property in Chester Township. First, regarding the transportation systems, the road structure of the Highlands represents the largest single source of existing impervious cover disrupting water recharge. If the RMP were simply to state that all non-federal and non-state Highland roads were to have their macadam impervious cover removed and return to the traditional dirt road form, then all the other pages of the burdensome RMP would not be needed. McMansions would not be built where commutes are difficult. Existing McMansions would decline in value, sharing the pain of environmental protection. Children could ride their bikes on the dirt roads again. Agriculture would return and flourish. Air quality would be improved. Water recharge would be increased. Municipalities would save money on road costs, and the budget dollars needed for this process could be eliminated. Point number two. Ms. Carluccio's suggestion that all controversial issues should be left to the waiver process. Please be reminded that the waiver process represents a staggering financial burden and represents such an extreme hardship that it is de facto not a feasible or practical remedy for the average person. Yet Ms. Carluccio expresses deep concern for the quote-unquote big deal of the towns having to prepare economic impact plans. But the towns get grants for impact plans. Individuals don't get grants for the waiver process. What a great idea. Let's have grants for individuals that need to apply for waivers. Point number three. Mr. Dillingham's comment that fee monies should be used for infrastructure and not used in the HDC bank represents a statement that landowners need not be compensated. Please hear loudly what he said. Next point. Regarding the thought that excavators, masons, carpenters, excavators, and others will retrain and build new and vibrant careers in ecotourism, and the thought that in the future speculation that Microsoft will move to Morristown, I comment, get real and stop filibustering. I note that all council members whose term has expired and who have not been reappointed are no longer voting members of this council. I also note that those council members who receive salaries from environmental advocacy groups, i.e. the paid lobbyists, have a conflict of interest on many issues before this council and should recuse themselves from voting on environmental matters that come before this council. My last comment is you are inflating the TDR money supply of available just compensation and are rendering the HDCs nothing more than funny money. This is a very important issue, and I would like to request a little bit of extra time to address it.
You're requesting that right now?
Mm-hmm. I want to continue, and I know my 3 minutes is up.
How much longer would you like to go on?
2 minutes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Dillingham says that you shouldn't go beyond the statute. The statute says TDRs should be issued for the preservation zone. The statute does not say that TDRs should be issued for exemptions if you don't want to use them. The statute does not say that TDRs should be issued in the planning area. The statute specifically tells you that there are two remedies, or two of many remedies, for just compensation. One's the TDRs, and the other is the exemptions. Don't use the TDRs to buy up the exemptions. It's not what the Highlands Act says. Now, let me make an example. If the compensation required to compensate all landowners in the preservation area is $100, it's a fixed $100. There's so many people in the preservation area that have been harmed. It's a fixed number. You guys should know what that fixed number is by this time. Now, if it takes another $100 to provide the TDRs for buying exemptions and for compensating people in the planning area, we now have a $200 pot instead of the original $100 pot. You don't have the $100 to begin with. You have about $1 of the $100. So increasing the $100 required pot to $200 just means we'll never, ever, ever get there. You have to keep the just compensation pot that's in the Highlands Act, directed for harmed landowners in the preservation area, dedicated to only that purpose. That's only fair. You're inflating the ADS supply. You're creating funny money out of it, and most people don't understand this. May I also suggest that if you want to compensate people for natural resource protection and for planning area HDCs and for the exemptions, it might not be a bad idea, but it's got to be a separate dedicated pot, a different category of TDRs. You can have TDRs A and then TDRs B, and then you need to say that TDRs B can't be cashed in until all of TDR A's have been compensated. The landowners in the Highlands preservation area get seniority. Everything else must be subordinated. This is very possible if you have some people with some financial expertise focus on this, that I actually believe a TDR structure is possible if there's a will. But what you're doing here today, by inflating that pot, you're making it absolutely impossible. Don't do it.
Just say one factual thing in terms of your comments. Members of the council and any state commission whose terms have expired do have full rights as a member until they are replaced.
Elliot Rubin, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. And it has come quite a relief to hear that the council will revisit the proposed changes in what disturbances are allowed within the prime ground recharge areas. And just to emphasize what a dramatic departure these proposed figures are from what is currently in the final draft, I'd like to read for you into the record the final draft program regarding prime groundwater recharge review standards, which is on page 323, or begins on page 323 of the final draft master plan. Quote, the RMP prohibits land uses within any prime groundwater recharge area that may reduce recharge volumes, or rather uses that may impair water quality within or draining to a prime groundwater recharge area. Any development activity in a prime groundwater recharge area must demonstrate that an equivalent of 125% of pre-existing recharge volumes of the site will be provided for within the same sub-watershed or by other means as determined by the Highlands Council. Further, the RMP prohibits the creation of impervious surfaces and other surfaces that significantly impede recharge within a prime ground recharge area in the protection zone. In the conservation zone, land uses will be discouraged and restricted that may reduce recharge volumes or that may degrade water quality in areas within or draining to a prime groundwater recharge area. In both protection and conservation zones, modifications will be allowed to prime groundwater recharge area protection requirements only upon demonstration that any relief from protection requirements will not impair or reduce groundwater recharge quality or volumes, which I guess addresses Mr. Whitenack's concern for a de minimis impact. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council. My name is James Tripp. I am general counsel of the Environmental Defense Fund. Our primary sort of involvement with this plan has been helping to think about the transfer development rights receiving area program, not the sending area program. In my view, that's relatively easy. The tough part is the receiving area program. But let me just, before I comment on some of the statements in the landowner equity program, let me just get back to a moment to the policy on water resources and the policy that you were debating earlier about the protection area. I agree with a number of comments. The 15% is far too high. Tim talked about the coastal zone management program where it's 3%. If you look at the New Jersey Pinelands plan, a comparable area might be the forest area program, which I think is probably much closer to 1%. If you look at overall average density. But the other thing, given the, in terms of clustering, if you're going to consider that at all, the cluster ought to be only solely limited to clusters within the prime groundwater recharge area, if there's any kind of development right. You don't want clusters coming from outside into the prime groundwater recharge area. In terms of waivers, I think the only real waiver of significance is the to avoid a takings. And you might think about establishing a prime groundwater recharge septage use sort of cap and trade program. If you, particularly where a takings may be an issue, or if you end up with a density limitation on a lot of the forest area, and people have smaller parcels where people can, in extremis, go to the bank and buy a septage use allocation and pay money for it. There is a great deal of value to the privilege to be able to put any kind of groundwater pollution, any kind of nitrogen, into a prime groundwater recharge area. It has high value, and you ought to treat it accordingly. Just sort of one suggestion on that. In terms of the development of the TDR receiving area program, I would suggest that as you think about policy on redevelopment and smart growth as well as landowner equity, but particularly redevelopment and smart growth, you'd be thinking about the relationship between those policies and the TDR receiving area program. I just didn't see any reference in those two sections to TDR receiving area. And smart growth, increasing density, whatever it is, all of it should be tied into a TDR receiving area program.
We have been working with council staff, looking at different kinds of TDR receiving area scenarios that could be put into place relatively quickly. If you think about landowner equity and the flows of dollars over time to people who are going to deserve equity, there's no way in which it can all be done all at once. But you can think of in 5, 10, 20 years, sequencing and prioritization. If the most readily available receiving area land is vacant land, in our view, there may be some redevelopment land that can be done, but probably the most readily used land is going to be vacant land. And we've been doing an analysis looking at the existing community zone that is about 80,000 acres, of which about 12,000 acres is undeveloped, at least according to the data of the council. Some of that may have been developed since then. And looked at a variety of different, what pieces of that 12,000 acres could serve as a receiving area under various circumstances. And what kinds of densities would you allow? Those have sort of been the two variables. And then we have a model where we try to calculate the what we call the total willingness of developers to pay to use those additional density rights in some subset of the 12,000 acres of vacant land in the existing community zone. The values that we get range from a little less than $40 million, which is not a whole lot, to about $1 billion. So there is a, there is potential. Just looking at that particular subset of receiving area land to achieve significant value. It's not going to be achieved all at once, but again, there is some flow that can occur over time. And we've just looked at the residentially zoned land. If you look at commercially zoned land, there could be more. If you start looking at redevelopment areas, there could be more. If you start looking in the seven counties outside of the region, there could be more. Statewide, there may be more. But in our view, it is important very early on, if the TDR program is going to have credibility, to get away from what the former speaker referred to as the funny money concept. There has got to be receiving area capacity that is readily available for development, which is attractive for development, that can achieve significant value.
I'm going to finish your stop.
Yep.
We're going to obviously continue this discussion. Other comments? Yes.
Bill Kibler, South Africa Watershed Association. I'm going to have to turn the calendar back a couple of meetings. I apologize for doing that. It may be a good example of why it's helpful for us to have access to some of the documents a little bit before the meetings so that we can provide timely and meaningful comments. So although these comments won't be timely, hopefully they'll at least be meaningful. I want to talk about the recommendation made by staff to council, I think two meetings ago, to allow municipalities in the planning area to use the DEP statewide nitrate standard of 2.0 milligrams per liter for determining septic system densities in those communities. I was left kind of scratching my head after that proposal was made. The nitrate standard of 2.0 milligrams per liter, DEP's standard, doesn't protect, restore, and enhance water quality here in the Highlands. You know that because your model tells you that it's not protective. So I was left to wonder, why would you allow municipalities to use a standard that you know is not adequately protective? Whether they love you or hate you, the municipalities look to you and to DEP as the state environmental experts for the region that they're in. If you fail to support your own science, you undercut the science-based approach to planning. And you undercut your own credibility with the municipalities. Municipalities ask themselves, why should I trust an agency that doesn't trust its own science? You tell us and the municipalities that you're using a science-based approach, but this proposal would ignore your own science. You say that you're blind to the line, but this proposal would basically have you follow the line and require folks on one side of required municipalities on one side of the line to adhere to the science-based standard that you've adopted, and would allow municipalities on the other side of the line to simply ignore the science. DEP's nitrate policy recognizes that the 2.0 milligrams per liter standard may not be sufficiently protective, and that a more restrictive regional standard may be better. That's certainly the case here. Your own model illustrates that very clearly. We've been waiting 100 years to get this right. Please don't fall prey to expediency. Don't make the mistake of defaulting to DEP's statewide one-size-fits-all standard. Enforce the right standard, the science-based standard, your standard, here in the Highlands. I want to just touch on two other things real quickly. The impervious surface issue has been discussed a little bit already in the prime groundwater recharge area. I saw the numbers for the first time this morning when I picked up the paperwork. I have to say I was appalled. The numbers, the percentages were at least 300% higher than I would have expected. The right number, the right percentage in the protection area is zero. We've got significant water quality and quantity issues already, and increasing impervious limit on prime groundwater recharge areas to the percentages that I saw in the paperwork and up on the board today would make that situation significantly worse. The last item, I always like to end on positive notes. The South Branch Watershed Association supports the concept of a water use fee. I was very pleased to see the council publicly support that also. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Andy Drysdale, Chester Township. Here we are, over 4 years past the onerous retroactive date of March 29, 2004. The state of New Jersey has a huge debt and a reputation for being one of the most business-unfriendly states in the entire country. People are leaving New Jersey to pursue a better life elsewhere. Yet the white-collar crime perpetrated the Highlands Act continues to be condoned. On February 28, 2008, the Highlands Council authorized an annual amount not to exceed $1.5 million for initial assessment grants to municipalities within the seven Highlands counties in furtherance of plan conformance. I am not sure what the nasty stick is, but it certainly is a rotten carrot. In May 1st, 2008, article in the Daily Record of Morris County regarding the merger of the Chesters, it was stated, and I quote, Corzine announced earlier this year his plan to cut state relief aid in half of the communities with under 10,000 residents and eliminate it altogether for those populations smaller than 5,000. He also made about $32 million available to towns wishing to explore mergers. It is obvious in this statement what the nasty stick is, and the $32 million rotten carrot shows us how wasteful government can be. This money could have been used for honest purchases of development rights. When you first hear of it, it sounds good, consolidation of services. But when you examine it further, you can see how bad the whole idea is without spending $32 million to come to that conclusion. First, it is a dilution of your vote. Second, history shows us that though there could be some merger savings at first, very large communities have a much larger cost per capita for government services. See Steve Lonigan's book, titled Putting Taxpayers First, page 77, for the statistics. Bigger is not always better, and forced or bribed consolidation are only tools used by socialists to promote their agenda and increase their power over the people. Please, Highlands Council, help us stop these abuses of power. Tell the legislature and the governor and the bloated NJDEP to stop this nonsense, and that a first good step would be to overturn the ill-conceived Highlands Act. Thank you.
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I'm sure you all read the newspapers cover to cover every day. Recently, the Star Ledger's business section earlier this week said that real estate in New Jersey is bucking the national trend. The real estate in New Jersey rose an average of 3.2% in the most recent period that they covered. Maybe we're not doing everything quite so badly here. Impervious cover versus disturbance. It's really hard for us to make meaningful comment because we don't see the documents until we arrive. But I was impressed that in the paper on recharge, it talks about impervious cover, and the numbers in the paper are 15% for protection, 30% for conservation zone, and 45% for the EC, existing community zone, for impervious cover. There is a huge difference between impervious cover and disturbance. And those numbers, as you have heard, are very, very high. This would be a major policy change for you to take. I am very pleased that you are sending this back. I think it's as important that there be a scientific rationale provided for this policy change. But the process that you have set up basically excludes the public from having meaningful say, just as Bill was just talking about something where here we are two meetings later and he's having an opportunity to comment. When you take a straw poll, please, on an issue, would you also open it up for, before you take the straw poll, for an opportunity for the public, uninformed as we may be, to at least have a comment before, because I think that what we say will inform your thoughts. So give us that opportunity, please. Otherwise, we really are. We're very much excluded from this process. As far as the science that you should be looking at, there has been a lot of this already done in New Jersey for recharge areas, and the Pinelands is a perfect place to look at. There is no need for you to reinvent the wheel and to spend a lot of time checking out the science. It has been done for you. You can start there. The Center for Watershed Protection is another. Tom Schuller probably in this country has done more work on this than anybody else. So that is another place that you can look to. I wanted to thank you, though, for your what I think see as strengthenings, maybe clarifications, but strengthenings to your section on cost protection. I think it's much better than where you started out, which was zero. You used to not have a position on cost, so you've come a long way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Chopin, and keeping with the current means of identifying yourself, I'm a member of the Farm Bureau and a former Boy Scout. Debbie Post, many years ago, floated an idea as to how to raise money for funding the TDR Bank, and it was an excellent idea that nobody picked up on, so let me bring it to your attention again. She suggested that a small fraction of a building permit anywhere in the state have a component which will fund the TDR program. And she mentioned it seemed too simple to work. Perhaps that's its problem. I don't know. But you may want to consider it again. It would raise a huge amount of money in a very small manner because it would be spread out over anybody who wants to build anywhere in the state. Let me acknowledge the receipt from Mrs. Swan was something that I requested. Of course, this isn't what I got. What I requested was a peer-reviewed study on the health detriment to drinking water with a nitrate concentration of over 10 milligrams per liter. What I got was something that says that Congress passed the act which specifies 10 milligrams per liter, not two, 10. Are we here in New Jersey 5 times weaker than the rest of the nation? Can we tolerate 1/5 the nitrates of the rest of the nation? I guess the answer is yes, because that is the DEP standard. And even that standard is not good enough for the Highlands area, where in the preservation area, 88 acres of forest land is required to achieve a nitrate dilution of less than 1 milligram per liter. But what it says is Congress passed it because they believe that's the appropriate standard. Well, most of Congress would believe in a Christian God, too. I'm not going to ask them to defend their religious feelings, but I am going to ask them to defend their scientific conclusions, which says 10 milligrams per liter is about all we can stand. I'm still waiting for the peer-reviewed medical study on nitrates in the water. And on the cover of it, I noticed that it says drinking water for kids. I believe that's the kind of stuff that you've given me in an endeavor to shut me up. Well, it's not going to work. I still want it. If you can't produce it, just say so. And I'm also going to ask you, because I looked in the last release of your master plan, the science, I want to see the data that you use to determine water deficit areas. Where is it in your master plan? If it is not in your master plan, where is it in the technical releases that you may have and I don't have? I want to see that too, because I think that is in the same category of 2 milligrams per liter or less. And then in the study by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, they interviewed the legal climate of all 50 states. And this is one of the components that I believe puts New Jersey in 50 out of 50 in terms of business friendliness. We are the last. And one of the components is the legal climate of the state. And I'll furnish you a copy of this little one-page thing, which will give you a link to their website should you want to see the entire report. It says, New Jersey has also gained a reputation for allowing junk science to be admitted into the courtroom, dropping a rank from 13th to 35th in the handling of technical and scientific evidence. This is in 1 year, 13th to 35th, and you haven't even released your master plan yet. So, also, I want to see that information as well. When a town does a master plan, or when you are doing a huge master plan, the master plan will be changed, and in this case, to the detriment of the landowners and farmers, by demographics. I've said it to you before, I'll say it to you again. The average age of a farmer in New Jersey in 2002 was 57 and going up. Kurt all said over here is the exception, not the rule. There will be, by my estimation, 250,000 acres coming onto the market because the younger generation is, generally speaking, not getting into farming because it doesn't pay. So you can do all the master plans you want. There will be 250,000 acres that will be coming onto the market, to which the families and the owners of this land will be offered pennies on the dollar. That's the deal. You know it. I know it. Address it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. I'm going to start with compliments first. The smart growth section, I think, is much improved. Has some details about how, you know, what smart growth actually consists of. However, I do caution, along with Mr. Dillingham, about not following the stormwater management play-it-by-the-numbers evaluation of how these are implemented. Secondly, the transportation section. I'm glad to see that standards for protection, or at least an objective regarding the protection of scenic resource viewsheds and corridors is in the transportation section. I think that's very good. And you know, the two items that deal with that, objectives 5C, 4C, and 4B. However, in the transportation section, in the prelude to it, we have noted before that the transportation, balanced transportation goal only is stated in the regards to the planning area. In the final draft plan, there is a chart which has information in it which divides the goals into those that apply to both the planning and the preservation area, the goals as stated for the preservation area and the goals as stated for the planning area. The transportation goal is, I believe, the last goal on that chart, and it only applies in the Act, it only applies to the planning area. There is a conspicuous lack of a transportation goal in the regional master plan for the preservation area. I think this needs to be acknowledged in the prelude to the transportation section and in the language throughout the goals and policies and objectives for this as to how these should be carried out in the planning area versus the preservation area. There needs to be a recognition that the law distinguished between the two parts of the Highlands as regards to transportation. And there needs to be some thought given to that. There must have been a reason that it was done that way in the law. Third, my statement that I'm addressing the landowner equity section. We do agree that we would like to see sending areas be able to be created in the planning area because there is definitely a lot of land in the both protection zone and the conservation zone in the planning area that deserves to be permanently protected and deserves to be able to be a sending area, and we would like to see that remain in the plan. Now, getting to the water resources section. In the Act, Section 34B says that measures to ensure that existing water quality shall be maintained, restored, or enhanced. I was shocked by the numbers being proposed for this section. I think one of the things that needs to be, clearly these are very different from numbers in other planning agencies' standards, as has been pointed out in the Pinelands and in the coastal area. One of the things I think needs to be really looked at is my understanding of the geology of the Highlands is that the prolific aquifers are the buried valley fill aquifers, which are along the river corridors. They are along the Musconetcong, along the Rockaway River, and many of these areas are in the existing community zone or in the conservation zone in the planning area. They are not in the preservation area, I think, because most of the preservation area is the higher elevation, forested areas with good habitat, whereas these river corridors are the ones that have the prolific aquifers. So I think to simply base standards on whether an area is in the protection zone, the conservation zone, or the existing community zone may not make a lot of sense in regards to aquifers, the prolific aquifer recharge, because these areas are either in the conservation zone, they're overlaid by farmland, or they are, many of them, they're in towns like along the Rockaway River.
which is underlain by these aquifers. So they are the critical water supply that is feeding the rivers and everything, and so they need to be looked at separately, and the just basing the standards on the zones alone may not make total sense. Further, it is clear that the percentage of disturbance that should be allowed should be greatly minimized, and should be, it really should read a lot more like what Elliot read in the first, in the final draft, and not be changed to this standard at all. So I'm glad to see that this is going to be readdressed. I mean, this was the purpose of the Act, to preserve the water supply, and this is a step in the wrong direction.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Sylvia Kovacs, Warren County. First, I'd really like to agree with Helen Heinrich on the need for planning for small business development, but more importantly, for sustainable agricultural development and the supporting businesses for a viable agricultural economy in the Highlands. Secondly, there were a lot of documents today that I have to admit I haven't had a chance to read yet, but with regards to the prime groundwater recharge discussion and the overview chart that was not part of the handouts, if I might bring up 2 points, one in particular dealing with Tim's point of the low-impact development not being proven enough to base policies on, I couldn't agree more. I have some concerns about how you actually enforce those LID projects. There's a major sub-development behind my small farm in the preservation area that was an LID project and is still touted as such. But the developers seem to have been able to clear-cut the first four parcels of that subdivision and has decided, and the township is still touting this as a low-impact development. By the time the township found out about it, it's too late. Clear-cut was already happening. So serious thoughts really need to be to be coming before this council as to how you enforce LIDs. I think that's absolutely essential, so thank you for bringing that point up. Next, with regards to the overview chart that talked about the protection zone having a 15% max limit, conservation zone having a 30% max limit, and the existing community zones is having a 45% max limit. If my notes are correct, the 45% came up with based on the sort of zoning that we already have. I'd like to put forward that it is the responsibility of this Highlands Council to make sure that we address exactly that type of development. You are not here to continue to promote that kind of development. Lastly, I'd like to thank the council and the staff for supporting and providing testimony to push for a water user fee. I think it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
I'm Jody Anderson, a landowner from Lebanon Township. I'm in strong agreement with Kurt Alstead's comments under landowner equity. There needs to be an emphasis statement of commitment to compensation to landowners. What's presented today was all about TDR. I urge continued emphasis on dedicated funding for the preservation area. I would like to see a definite top priority requirement for all consideration of compensation. The age of owners. This has already been going on for 4 years. I see no end in sight. I don't know if you do. I don't. Call it landowner equity. Call it landowner fairness, or call it do the right thing.
John Millay, Raritan Highlands Compact. I'm also a township committee person in Bernards Township, which is in the planning area. I would like to obvious as I attend these meetings that you folks put in a lot of work and a lot of time, staff and council. I would like to thank you for that, first of all. However, I have to say that on some occasions it strikes me that you folks are discussing what color to paint your house when there's a hurricane bearing down upon you. The hurricane I'm referring to is Kola. I was privileged to attend a meeting in Somerville a few weeks ago where Ms. Swan and Larry Beyer from the DEP gave us a very interesting technical talk with regards to the county's wastewater management plan. I found it made a lot of sense to me and seemed to be well-founded in fact and method. Unfortunately, I sat in the same room the following evening and listened to Commissioner Doria of the DCA basically contradict most of what Ms. Swan and Mr. Beyer said. Again, it's gratifying to hear you spend 15 or 20 minutes wordsmithing the language for economic development in the Highlands region. However, I would remind you at the same time that COA and the DCA are intending for every business that wants to come in here or expand, whether it's Mr. Allstead's farm or whether it's the BASF, former BASF property in Mount Olive or whatever, to pay onerous fees to support affordable housing. I get the feeling that what this group here is doing is good and well-founded, but there is another elephant on a parallel track which doesn't seem to be paying much attention to this. And I've several other examples from today's discussion. The discussion of a potential fee for any town that wants to increase its zoning density if it uses water from the Highlands. The Council on Affordable Housing basically wants every town in the state to utilize inclusionary zoning, which would be a de facto increase in the zoning of every town, whether it uses Highlands water or not. I could cite several other examples of what you were speaking on today. I would respectfully suggest that until the issue of coordination between this body and that of COA is resolved, I think you're spinning a lot of wheels. There's no guarantee that what you are very carefully crafting is going to be observed or be utilized by another significant state agency, and I would urge that every effort and every resource be used at this point to that's Joe Dory on the phone, by the way, come to an agreement, a memorandum of understanding or whatever between the agencies, because until that is done, what I perceive to be a almost 180 degree difference in policies needs to be resolved, or it needs to be established that it cannot be resolved, which may be just as important. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the public comments. If council members have other comments?
Two thoughts, Mr. Chairman. One is, when the staff does the white paperwork on the aquifers, recharge areas, you could look at where the prime recharge areas lie vis-a-vis the zones, to go to Loma's point, that would be interesting to know, because maybe there's a policy that needs to be divorced from the zone itself. And secondly, just to go to Mr. Malay's comments, I would like a better understanding. People, obviously, there's a great deal of concern about the impact of the COA regulations, and we've raised that issue and talked about it ourselves. But in all of this, it seems to me this presumption that COA trumps the Highlands Act. And I would like a clearer understanding of what the legal relationship is between the act. Should we not be able to come to some agreement, memorandum agreement, as to how it gets played out? I'd like to know whether or not towns might be treated differently under COA if they're conforming to the act as opposed to not conforming, and sort of those questions. Because I would hope that the Forsyth administration and DCA would work towards resolving these differences and not allow COA to wreak environmental havoc on the Highlands. We spent 4 years trying to craft this plan, but the statements that I hear coming out of DCA don't give me a lot of comfort that that's indeed what's going to happen. So I do think that we need to understand exactly where we are vis-a-vis that eventuality or that possible eventuality. I guess I'd like Mr. Gordon's opinion on that.
Other comments? Okay. It's copied in the New Jersey Municipalities Magazine, if any council members want. Okay, our next council meeting is next Thursday at 4 o'clock. The TDR committee will be 15 minutes?
15 minutes?
Yeah. At,
right here?
5 after 5, 5 after 1.
That's the end time.
Right. So motion to adjourn?
Move.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Thank you.
Aye.
Thank you.